morning, Cascadia. You're listening to your community radio station, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, at 90.7 FM. Today's Tuesday, March 17th, 2009, and this is Air Cascadia. Long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
The Ninth Circuit Court rules a pro-developer and con Salmon in San Francisco.
The Tacoma and Olympia newspapers both announced layoffs yesterday.
And the National Association of Broadcasters is suing the Federal Communications Commission.
Portland area weather, mostly cloudy, showers likely in the north, highs around 50. Winter advisory for the North Cascades until 5 o'clock. Tonight, rain here, snow in the mountains, temperatures in the 30s and 40s. Tomorrow, more of the same.
And first we go to local regional news from around Cascadia. We talked this morning with Brenna Bell of Tryon Life Family Farms about the issue of grey water. Good morning, Brenna. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning.
First off, could you tell listeners what grey water is? What do we mean by that phrase?
Sure. Grey water is water that's used for purposes in the home or in the business other than toilet flushing, basically everything other than what's called black water. So it's your kitchen sink, it's your laundry runoff, it's your shower or bath drain. It's water that's been used once but could very well be used again for another purpose.
So there has been some talk of legislation that would allow people to use gray water in gardens and farms rather than wasting it. Mm-hmm. Water, of course, being the new oil and becoming more valuable as it gradually drips away.
Yeah, over the past year, there's been a really strong concerted effort across a broad variety of interests to make gray water use more accessible. And through some great actions from the State Plumbing Board, the interior reuse of gray water got approved earlier this year, so you can flush your toilet, say, with your sink or with your shower. But the main sticking point was the reuse of water outside to irrigate your lawn or your garden. And to change the state's rules on that, we actually had to change a statute. The statutory definition of gray water basically labeled it as sewage, and, of course, the state isn't going to allow us to dump sewage outside. So throughout the past year, a broad coalition of people has been meeting and came up with a draft legislation that would basically, I mean, it's a two-step process. The legislation changes the wording and instructs the Department of Environmental Quality to start a rulemaking to create the rules for gray water. And we passed a major hurdle yesterday when the House of Representatives voted 49-10 in favor of the legislation. So that's the first major step in making exterior gray use legal and accessible.
And then where do we go from this point on?
Well, there's a lot more organizing to do. The bill still has to go to the Senate and then get approved by the governor. And then the real work is going to happen on the state level when the rulemaking occurs, because there are obviously people who want to, you know, make it a very technical, expensive solution. And there are people who want a very organic, biological approach. And so there's a lot of time for people to get involved in making sure that the state, you know, continues to listen to the voice of the people and make it as accessible as possible.
And, of course, Tryon Farms, as always, leading the way with organic innovation. Brenna Bell, thank you so much. My guest, of course, is Brenna Bell with Tryon Life Farm. Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yesterday in San Francisco, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the federal government's discretion to use hatchery salmon to bolster wild runs, but not as a substitute that would lift Endangered Species Act protections. The ruling included the last of a series of lawsuits on behalf of a coalition of builders, farmers, and property rights advocates to remove restrictions on development and agriculture that protect salmon. It also covered a challenge by conservation groups to a decision by NOAA Fisheries to downgrade protections for steelhead in the Upper Columbia from endangered to threatened.
It sounds good on the surface, but it still smells of dead fish underneath. As debt grows, so grows the debt management industry. State regulators say that they're going to keep a watchful eye on the growing number of debt management companies that offer to pare down credit card balances or modify home mortgages as the recession deepens. The problem is that too many debt reduction schemes end up sinking the consumer deeper into debt. And many of the services that they sell are available free anyway through various government plans. Many of these organizations are based outside of Oregon. They advertise through the mail, they broadcast, and, of course, they advertise online. Some ads suggest that their services are affiliated with a government agency. Don't be fooled.
Down and out in Cascadia. We're not number one, but we're close to the nation's top unemployment rate, especially if you factor in all the people who have given up or joined the underground economy. We're officially at 10.8%. Like Spinal Tap, we've turned it up to 11.
Oregon is in line for nearly $81 million in grants from the Obama administration to bolster their home's energy efficiency. The new grants are part of a nationwide investment of nearly $8 billion under the President's American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and that's fine. But it would have been nice to see some of that stimulus money go for infrastructure improvement or innovative energy projects, not forest thinning, which is really logging writ small.
Legislators are looking around for ways to stop the bleeding. School budgets are being slashed and salaries frozen, but the state-created Energy Trust of Oregon is handing out tens of millions of dollars to big companies for conservation projects and bumping up pay and benefits for its staff. So lawmakers are looking for ways to tap its rapidly growing bank account instead of learning from the Energy Trust what it's doing right and what they're doing wrong.
And around the world, ports are feeling the global tsunami, and this is just, of course, the first wave. The port of Portland, a huge employer that runs the port and the airport, expects layoffs as the global economic crunch clobbers transportation. When the peak oil aftershock hits, we'll be trading in those huge shipping containers for wheelbarrows. Again, not such a bad idea. I think that many wheelbarrows are actually still made in the United States.
Here's the story. Oregon will receive half of the $33 million in federal recovery funds to help clear brush and prevent wildfires. This is Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack's idea of progressive investment. Oregon's $16.5 million allocation will pay for hazardous fuel reduction projects in Curry, Douglas, Josephine, Jefferson, Deschutes, and Crook counties. The work will employ about 100 people with private companies already under contract with the Forest Service.
And now, the National Association of Broadcasters, or the NAB, is suing the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, for defying the Radio Broadcasting Preservation Act when it granted waivers to keep low-power radio on the air. Confused? With me this morning to talk about the lawsuit is the champion of low-power radio, info activist and community radio leader, Pete Tridish, head of Prometheus Project. Good morning, Pete. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, it's great to be on KABU.
I understand you're in Washington, D.C., seeing this the lawsuit through the court system.
Yes, I'm in D.C., and the lawsuit was yesterday around midday, and we watched the oral arguments between the FCC's attorneys and the National Association of Broadcasters' attorneys.
What is it that the FCC has done or failed to do in this case? What is the nut of it?
Well, you know, it's a long history, but the FCC, when they made low-power radio, there's one thing that we really felt that they did wrong, which was they made it secondary to full-power stations. So when a full-power station wants to move, it suddenly becomes any low-power stations that are in the way can suddenly get knocked off the air. And that wasn't too big a problem for the first bunch of years of low-power FM, but in 2006, the FCC streamlined the process for full power moves, and all of a sudden, hundreds of low power radio stations were slated to lose some of their coverage, and up to 40 of them would have been ordered all the way off the air. So when the FCC saw that this was the result, that wasn't really what they had intended, they went over their rules and they came up with a set of measures that made it easier for the low power FM stations to actually stay on the air by giving them some more flexibility in moving their channel. And in some cases, even by telling the full power stations that they can't move if the low power FM has no place to move out of the way to. The National Association of Broadcasters claimed that that violated the Radio Broadcasting Preservation Act of 2000 by, well, basically by giving the low-power firms a lifeline and allowing them to stay on the air.
So how is it that low-power stations then would – how do you see this working out in the end for low-power stations?
Well, it's difficult to say. Would like to claim that the FCC violated the law here, but the way we see it, the FCC was very, very scrupulous. There was really quite a number of things that we think that the FCC should have done to help out low-power stations that they didn't do because that would violate the law. But we think that the FCC took an approach that followed very, very closely the actual letter of the law. And the NAB has a very broad interpretation. Basically, it thinks that any low-power station on any adjacency is covered by the law, whereas the law really clearly just says that it's about the third adjacent. And what the FCC had actually done was it gave some waivers in very limited circumstances to low-power stations on second adjacent channels. And while this looks a little crazy, the truth is often with sophisticated engineering tools, you can see places on the dial that really are clear for low-power firms, but they just aren't obvious when you use the very, very blunt tools of what's called the minimum spacing rules. So the FCC just took it up a notch in terms of how closely they were willing to look to find a new home for the low-power station, and for that they're getting sued.
Thank you so much for that. I suppose that what we conclude from all of this is that one way or another, information does want to be free. My guest has been Kate Trittish, head of the Prometheus Project. Thank you so much for that, and we'll see you in Portland soon for the NFCB conference.
Looking forward to it.
Thanks so much.
More bad news in the newspaper industry. The News Tribune of Tacoma is reducing its staff by 30, and the Olympian is cutting 15 positions. The jobs will be lost in all areas of the newspaper, including the newsroom.
I miss newspapers. Agribusiness eats its own. In Medford, the Fruit Growers League, founded in 1913 to help Rogue Valley pear growers fight a blight, has disbanded. The organization is yet another victim of consolidation in the growing business. At its formation to deal with fire blight, the bacterial disease that kills pear trees, there are about 400 pear growers in Jackson County. Through the decades, the Fruit Growers League tackled orchardist issues such as pest control, air quality, and land use laws. They're gone now, and agribusiness is set up in the place.
Democratic Representative Chuck Riley thinks the Oregon Constitution has gotten bloated and confusing. He wants a constitutional convention, the first one since statehood, but the House Rules Committee is skeptical.
And we don't have D.C. Dirt today. Spencer Raymond is not able to be with us. Briefly, though, a nationwide populist anger that's boiling over with the AIG executives who are getting these $165 million in unearned bonuses. President Obama's promised to try to block these bonuses. And AIG, of course, is saying that they have to pay the bonuses out because it's already written into contracts that were transacted before all of this happened. The same people who went after the Keating Five now are on AIG, and we'll see how that holds up in court, as they say.
This has been Headlines and Commentary from Air Cascadia for Tuesday, March 17th, 2009. Erin Gobrach. Today's editor is Chris Andre. Engineering is Janet Anderson. The KBU AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Chris Andre. You're listening to member-supported KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM. Your support and your support only keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members.
Coming up next, flashpoints, the FMLN victory in Salvadoran elections, a report on the RNC 8, and an update on the West Bank.
syndicated radio finally catches up with us on the RNCA. Thanks for listening and have a good day.